We'll endeavour to take a short look at the short book of Obadiah this evening. It's maybe not just a matter of when we turn the page that we might miss it, but sometimes also in our approach to Scripture. We're not so mindful of a passage like this. It is the shortest book in the Old Testament, and it is chiefly addressed to Edom, one of Judah's neighbours, rather than to God's chosen people, Israel, as we might have come to expect in the Bible. And again, as I have tried to do with Amos, which endeavour to just take an overview of the book, even as I was reading it with you this evening. There were things that were coming out afresh and very tempting to go further into them. But just for a brief overview, just in the one evening, this single chapter, try and see where it fits into the larger scheme of things, what message may be found here. It's a small part, but it's no less an important part of God's self-revelation to men, including ourselves. So what I would try and do this evening is to just quickly go through the story of Edom, that we might understand a little better where it fits into things. The message to Edom, there is also a message to the nations, and a message to Judah. And then where does that leave us, a message to us as well? So first of all then, looking at Obadiah, the story of Edom, the background to this prophecy. Edom is the national name given or used by the descendants of Esau. You might have noticed, I hope you did, in reading through the prophecy, the number of times that the name Esau did appear, even as the name Jacob also appeared. Esau was, remember, the twin brother of Jacob, and Jacob's other name was Israel. Jacob was the father of the nation Israel. Esau was the father of the nation Edom. And that's why, in speaking the prophecy out, Obadiah uses the name Esau in verse 6, "Oh, how Esau shall be searched out," when he's talking about Edom. By this stage, it is the nation Edom. And then he also, further down, he speaks of your brother Jacob, using the old names, reminding the hearer of where these two nations have come from. And so let's go back just for a moment to the story of these two brothers, when they were born and when they grew up. Things were not exactly happy between them, were they? Up to the point where Esau, well, first of all, Jacob deceived and effectively robbed Esau of a vital thing, the birthright, as the firstborn. Being a twin, he was just marginally born before Jacob, but he was the firstborn. And the result was that Esau threatened Jacob's life. And they lived separate lives for a period. They came together again just briefly, and then they lived separate lives, and the nations grew from them for some period. The Bible doesn't record, as far as I can remember, any encounters between either of them or their descendants for the whole 400 plus years of Israel's time in Egypt. There was that brief meeting after Jacob came back to Canaan, and then they went separate ways. That was an agreed procedure between them, and then we read nothing more of them until after the exodus from Egypt. Israel had been there around 400 years, and then went out into the wilderness of Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula. And it was during their journey in the wilderness that we then find the next interaction. And here they are, nations. If you remember, when Israel first left Egypt within the first year, They reached the borders of Canaan and they were told to go in. They refused and they were turned back. And then they had to wander in the desert for 40 years. When they did eventually complete that period and were ready then to go back into the land of Canaan, they had to take a different route. Their approach had to be from the east. That's why they were crossing the Jordan, which they wouldn't have done the first time. But to get to that side of the river, the east side of Jordan, they had to first pass through Edom's territory, amongst others, but Edom was the first. You see, Edom had by that time settled in the area south of the Dead Sea. You might hopefully recall the lie of the land, where the River Jordan, the Jordan Valley, goes down the middle, and there is the Dead Sea at the bottom where it finishes. And it's south of that, in really rather rugged territory, that Edom had settled. Very harsh landscape. It was mountainous, as reflected by the prophecy. But it was also strategic. By that I mean it was of crucial importance, not just to Edom, but to many nations around, including Egypt, including those over in Mesopotamia and so on. Major trade routes passed through Edom's territory, which meant that for such a small people, it was a very influential nation or vitally important. Major nations, we found, would court Edom and try and come to treaties with them. On occasion, would try and subdue them, and that's actually what happened in the early years of the kings of Israel when they were doing well under David and Solomon. Israel had subdued and overrun and controlled the Edomite territory. I suppose one sidelight on this is that if Edom chose to, or parts of Edom, certain rogue elements perhaps, they could make themselves quite wealthy from the passing trade as well. It was a strategic place that they were. But because of Israel's new route to get into Canaan, in their hundreds of thousands, if not millions, were trying to follow that trade route. That's all they were trying to do, the King's Highway Moses talks about. From the west, from that wilderness area, trying to go around the south of the sea and up the east side of the river and the valley. But to get there, Edom had to agree. When you think of how many people there were in Israel trying to get through all at this one time, it's perhaps not surprising that Edom might have been, to say the least, apprehensive about what was going to happen. These people had been used to living in the desert, what was going to happen when they came and the various facilities were available for them. Moses knew that. Moses was aware of that kind of concern because he said to the king of Edom, "We're not going to touch anything. We're not even going to use your wells." And that was really very significant. It's like somebody saying, "Well, I'm going to take a whole stack of jerry cans in the back of my car so that I don't have to get petrol from here to Scotland or whatever." Similar to that, if you like. It was so important. As a result, Israel had to take a longer and harder circuit around Edom's territory. Edom's armies actually came out against Israel to stop them coming through, but Israel didn't respond. They didn't fight back at that particular point. But in Numbers 24, strangely enough, through the prophet Balaam, a heathen prophet, but one who couldn't do anything but give God's own word, it was there that God promised that Edom would one day become a possession of Israel. And that is repeated here, I believe, in Obadiah, in the last section, verses 18 through to 20. And so there was this interaction between the two nations as descendants of two brothers. As I said, in Israel's heyday, under David and Solomon, Edom did come under Israel's rule. After a while, Judah, when the nations split and Judah became weak and corrupt following the heathen ways of those around them, it was then that Edom was able to rebel and get out from under Judah's rule. There were a number of further conflicts as well that we can read of in places like the Book of Chronicles and so on. There is another interesting point in all of this, that in 2 Chronicles 25, if you want to jot it down, it's verse 20, there is a very interesting point that, well, take you back for a minute to Esau. Esau, when he was growing up, had no time for the God of his father and grandfather, Isaac and Abraham. He was going after the other gods around him. Yet in this time of weakness and corruption, Judah turned to the gods of Edom. And that was a condemnation that God brought on Judah. He said, you must not be serving their gods. It's such a reversal. And so there was this, as I say, this interaction. They bordered each other in the southern border of Judah. And then comes the phase that Obadiah seems to be referring to. But there is a picture here of Judah being overcome, Judah and Jerusalem. Most likely, therefore, it is a reference to Babylon's conquest of Judah and Jerusalem. And what we find is that when all of that happens, an outside power comes in, takes over Israel, Edom is looking on with grim pleasure. And so God's response to that, and all that history, is to warn them their own end is coming, and not far off. That sketches out the story of Edom. And so, as I say, coming to the message, this message, to those people. I've left it to here to refer more specifically to the timing or the date of the message. Unlike most of the other prophecies, we don't have any mention of kings or other historical hooks that we might connect with. It's not a simple identification of time or date. And so, in one sense, it is not a question that should concern us terribly, because otherwise it would be given to us. Yet, within the message itself, there are one or two clues that are worth registering, because they are given to us. They will enhance, they're meant to enhance our understanding of God's case against Edom. For example, we read several times that Edom, here's an example from verse 12, Edom rejoiced over, or gazed on the day of their brother, and rejoiced over them in the day of their captivity and destruction. That was their attitude in this case, and it tells us that it must have come after a significant event of destruction to Judah. I have referred to that just a moment ago. It's suggestive of all that fits in with the major fall of Jerusalem and Judah at the hands of Babylon. And so that would suggest that Obadiah is one of the later prophets. But it also is a message of warning to Edom that they are soon to suffer. In other words, Obadiah is preaching to them after Jerusalem was destroyed, but before Edom was destroyed. So somewhere in the middle. And from other evidence that we can find, history tells us that Edom was pushed out of that region that they had claimed as their own. It seems to be mainly Arabs who moved into that area at that point, around the 6th century BC. We can't put our finger on the precise point, not like Jerusalem. There is a precise year that we can mark there. But we do know that they were moved around about that point. They moved out. And unlike Judah, they never returned. If anything, they some of them at least, were able to settle in the southern regions of Judea, which is perhaps what is being referred to. The inhabitants of the south shall possess the mountains of Esau, and so on. They will be encapsulated, brought in under that southern part of Judea. And it would suggest that later on in the days of the Herods, around the time of Jesus even, there was a region called Idumea, which perhaps comes from Edom. But they didn't return to that place that they had regarded as their own, and that they were so proud of in the mountains south of Judah. Malachi, who writes after Judah's return from Babylon, does show that Edom had been removed by that time. The first chapter of Malachi talks about that. God is speaking to Israel, first of all, but he says, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated, and laid waste his mountains and his heritage for the jackals of the wilderness. Even though Edom has said, we have been impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places, thus says the Lord of hosts, they may build, but I will throw down. They shall be called the territory of wickedness, and the people against whom the Lord will have indignation forever. That should call to mind what God said through prophet Balaam concerning Edom. Because they would not help their brother Israel, they were ultimately to be removed altogether. So that is the context in which this message to Edom comes. The message is that their time has come. They've been allowed to go on for so long, but their time has come. The message contains reasons, first of all, in verses 10 through to 15. That word for at the beginning of verse 10 tells us that these are the reasons for what was going to happen to them. You should be able to see yourself what those reasons are. It was especially the main emphasis was on their treatment of God's chosen people. And not just that, but it was their treatment because of the pride of their own hearts. These are the two things that are running very strongly through God's message here. Take verse 12, I did refer to it a minute ago, but there are three times there in different ways that the condition of their heart is reflected. You should not have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity. What is that talking about? It's meaning that there are these hundreds and thousands of people being taken captive from Jerusalem, and Edom is just standing there looking on, not raising a finger to help them. And who knows, as you go on, you see the next part, nor should you have rejoiced. As they gazed, they were rejoicing, they were glad. They said this, essentially, I suppose, they were saying Judah's got their comeuppance. And nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Doesn't that reflect an attitude of heart? Verse 12 relates Israel to Edom, your brother. But verse 13 relates them to God. Perhaps Edom hasn't taken account of this. You should not have entered the gate of my people. You thought perhaps you were dealing with just a nation. But they're my people, God says. You should not have just stood by. It wasn't that they merely, either that they were merely unable to help Israel and stood by. They were unwilling. They rejoiced. They were gloating at Israel's demise. But then you read further and you find that they were also involved against Israel. In verse 14, you should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who escaped. Nor should you have delivered up those among them who remained in the day of distress. Edom was set out to make life or this captivity final for Judah, if they possibly could. They got involved against Israel. So there were reasons that God gives, but there are also results. In verses 2 to 9, it's where the results are to be found. Some of the results, they had been proud but they would be despised. Verse 2, you will be small among the nations. You will be greatly despised. Complete reversal for them. Isn't a fall always harder to take for the one who is proud and confident in their own strength? That's what was going to happen to Edom. It was going to be very painful for them. And then the Lord uses images from the very things that Edom had boasted of, the things that they'd relied on. They were strong. They had long been strong by virtue of their place in the hills and the rocks of that harsh region. Verse 3, pride of your heart has deceived you, you who dwell in the clefts of the rock, you who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? They'd relied on this for so long, and in one sense, rightly so, they'd have been very successful, but only in the sense of this world. God speaks of these very things and says, they won't save you from what I intend. When God had appointed their defeat, that was not any safety for them. Further than that, concerning the results, the outcome of their behavior, what God also insists on is a complete destruction. This was no small thing that was going to come on them, but something that they should be afraid of. From verse 4 onwards, You can go as far as you like. You can try and reach the highest places, your nest among the stars. From there I will bring you down, says the Lord. And then from verse 5, it uses a picture of a thief, it uses a picture of the grape gatherers. It says, they will go so far and they'll leave a bit. They won't be so complete, but that's not going to be the way in your case. Esau will be searched out, verse 6. Their time had come. It was to be a complete dealing with them that God had in view. Complete destruction. That destruction that is further talked about in verse 18 and 19 as well. The house of Esau shall be stubble. And he's referred already to Jacob and Joseph. They shall kindle them and devour them. No survivor shall remain of the house of Esau. For the Lord has spoken. It was going to be a complete destruction. That was the message to Edom here through Obadiah. As well as that, though, Obadiah does have a message for nations. It is very brief, certainly in comparison to what we have seen to Edom directly, but God does have something to say to the other nations as well. It wasn't only Edom that was going to meet with the Lord's judgment. Edom's judgment would be in the context of God's reckoning with all the nations. And that's in verse 15. The day of the Lord, this is the reason why this is going to happen to Edom whenever it does, because the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. It was within that context, that great plan of God, that it was to come on Edom as well. As it was to apply to Edom, as you have done, it shall be done to you. That certainly is what God had in view. So it was to be to all the nations as well. You find there, I think, the picture of the cup of God's anger. As you drank on my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been. He's using the picture of the cup of his anger. Why should this be to all the nations? And indeed this did come about. Habakkuk was one who had a question about the way that Judah was suffering at the hands of Babylon, a very sinful people. And God said, they're going to come to their end as well. Everyone did. Every nation did. All the nations around Israel would come to this day of the Lord, and the Lord would deal with them. Why? Why would this be? And this is not just to Edom, but it is to the nations. as you have done, it shall be done to you. Don't allow anyone to distort the Old Testament. Many have said, I've heard many say, that the Old Testament is a picture of great violence and slaughter, and that what they're trying to say is that it's wanton violence. It's careless, it's just at a whim. That's not the way. There are many violent episodes. There's no doubt about that. But it's not wanton violence. It's not just because somebody feels like it. Well, yes, when men have taken it on themselves, it has been something like that. But underlying it all is God's plan. And this is at the heart of God's plan. As you have done, it shall be done to you. God did use nations to administer his justice, but it was always just. And even God's own people were subject to it. That's why they had been taken into captivity already. Always remember, there's a precision about God's justice. There's no more and no less than what is warranted by man's pride and his rebellion against God. And I suggest that even the message of deliverance that follows in the last part of this prophecy reminds us of that. I spoke about it when we were talking about Amos. That God's deliverance does fit in. God's deliverance of men fits in even with this message of justice and of judgment. Because even where he does forgive, even where he has restored a remnant to Judah, and where he goes on showing forgiveness and grace to many, God has not set his justice aside. We know now, in this New Testament day, that he's absorbed that justice in himself in the form of his Son, who became flesh and took sin and the wrath of God against sin on himself on the cross. It's a very brief message to the nations concerning their judgment. Although it does extend a little further, but I'll take this up under the next section regarding the message to Judah. The message to Judah then. The way I would put it is that I think it's kind of twofold, presented at least in two ways. After all, to begin with at least, the message is to Edom, not Judah. It's another nation outside of Judah. But it's here in the Bible, in a sense the Bible of Judah. It's their word. It was heard by Judah. What were they to make of it when they heard these things? Well, first of all, Judah could hear God's plan for Edom. And God does this on a number of occasions. He did that at the beginning of Amos, for example. He's done it with Jonah and others. Judah could hear God's plan for this other nation. Speaking purely politically, Edom perhaps owed Judah no favors. But what you see portrayed here is a real meanness, really, from Edom towards Israel throughout their history. Why didn't they let them go through their land with the promises that they made, their undertakings? Why did they rejoice when they were taken into captivity? There's a real nastiness almost about that relationship from Edom towards Israel. And it wouldn't be the first time if Judah, in being taken captive, suffering conquest, had looked over their shoulder, as it were, as if to say to God, "What about these people? You're punishing us, but what about these people? Edom. They're sinners too." How often we do that? How often many people do that? But God has a consistent answer to any such objection. Because God is essentially saying, by this prophecy, in God's time, sin will be dealt with. all sin will be dealt with. That's part of the message, I think, to Judah, who may have, shall we say, at least overheard that message to Edom. Through it, they must know that in God's time, yes, that sin also will be dealt with. But then as well to Judah, there is the further passage that does refer to deliverance from verse 17 to the end of the chapter. And that includes God's people subduing those around them. They were to be reminded that for all that Edom had some success, Edom had endured longer than they had perhaps, for all that, they were still to be reminded that deliverance was to be found nowhere but where the one true and living God, their God, is to be found. Mount Zion is what that speaks of. That's where deliverance was to be found, where they were, where the land that God had promised to them. And God makes a further promise to them that they will be restored. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The only thing is that Judah still had to be very careful as they heard this. Because it's not just saying that they would be restored to prominence and success on their own and could do then as they pleased. Judah had to read to the very end, just as we do. That's partly why I read also in Peter, because that's where Peter comes to as well in the New Testament. At the very end of this prophecy, in verse 21, at the last sentence, "And the kingdom shall be the Lord's." This kingdom that they were to be part of and that would subdue all those around them, not just Esau, but also Philistine and Canaan and so on. But this kingdom was to be the Lord's. They had to be sure that they regard their restoration. If this was a prophecy that came between their being taken captive and their being restored again, they must remember this and view that restoration in the light of this. It also throws clear light, I think, on the reason for their own downfall earlier, that that's what they'd forgotten. They had a privileged position, but they'd forgotten that the kingdom was the Lord's. Judah, in the light of this message, had to remember how vitally important it was to learn obedience and service, that they were not to be proud any more than anyone else. And as Malachi brings out in that first chapter, their place in God's plans were to be based purely on his choice to love them. I read the section about Esau. Esau I have hated. And what has he done because he hated Esau? He was opposed to Esau, in other words. But working back from that, he had said, "Yet Jacob I have loved. I have loved you," says the Lord. And they had to always remember that. That it was based on his choice of them. And so just quickly then, having looked through these basic elements of the prophecy, let's consider just in closing what message this might be to us, to you. I've mentioned certain things that Judah had to learn. It should be so also for today's reading, for you and for me. And we must ask that question for passages such as this. What edification is there for me in the 21st century and for our church, the Church of Christ? And perhaps the most straightforward message for us is to beware of the danger of pride. We might no longer be able to make an exact equation between a modern nation and Edom. The character of nations is somewhat different, perhaps. But consider the heart of their sin. It was a rebellion against God. It was placing themselves very highly in their own view. whether it should be a nation or an individual today, the character of the sin is the same. And the results are so similar as well. I can recognize parallels between, take Edom. I can almost visualize them as Judah was being taken out of their land. It's as though Edom was looking on and watching them in their despair and their trouble, being taken by a heathen nation. And Edom, as we've noted, they looked on, they rejoiced, they harassed, they made sure the job was completed. Judah suffered. But Jesus, just in a couple of places that I would bring out very quickly. One place, remember, he was teaching on who is my neighbor. How do you treat your neighbor? The story of the Good Samaritan. Edom was really rather like those two men who thought they had it all right and passed on down the other side. Add to that that Israel was Edom's brother and God's people. Jesus said, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. Judah was down and out as they were being taken into captivity. Edom was self-satisfied. They didn't help. They didn't reach out to help. And that was held against them. So there are some of these things, perhaps, that we can take from this prophecy. And so there is warning over our hearts that we don't stumble into pride. As we read in 1 Peter chapter 5, God gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. But God resists the proud. Let's not go there. There is also an assurance that no sin will ever go unpunished. We sang Psalm 73, where the man came to understand even that. It's not me that's slipping, it's they who are slipping. And I know that now because I see God as he really is. There's also a reminder that we're to approach those in need. Edom didn't, quite simply. We're to approach them with the grace with which we ourselves have received. As I would suggest is there in Matthew 25 that I just read. And Edom had grace from God. They had lived for so long, everyone under the grace of God. Why had God not punished them long before? He left them to that place. And there is the key to it all. Our attitudes and our behavior will be transformed, just as Judah's had to be, just as Edom's ought to have been. If we remember this, that the kingdom is the Lord's. I'll just remind you of what Peter said. After all of this, he's speaking about the way that God is doing great things for his people. But to him be the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Not only had Edom forgotten that, from the days of Esau himself, but Judah had forgotten that too. They needed to hear this message. We need to hear this message. We must never let slip that the kingdom is the Lord's, that he is the one whom we live for, not ourselves. If I hadn't printed it earlier, I might have modified the title. I'm suggesting it's Making the Most of Obadiah. Well, perhaps we've made at least a little more of Obadiah tonight. May God bless his word to us, each one. Let us pray together.